say you don't need no diamond rings, and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of things the money just can't buy. I don't care too much for money, money can buy me love. Well, shake it up, baby, now.
Shake it up, baby.
Twist and shout.
Twist and shout.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, baby, now. She loved you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loved you, yeah, yeah, yeah. With a love like that, you know you should be glad. I feel happy inside.
I need you.
Listening to The Point, we are talking about the Beatles today. Glenn Gass teaches a series of courses on the history of rock and roll and popular music, including a class on the music of the Beatles at Indiana University. Professor Gass is a member of the Education Advisory Board of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum in Cleveland, and he joins us on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you have been teaching this Music of the Beatles class since 1982. So back in the 80s, the students were of an age that you might expect they would have been fans, but now these kids who are taking it now weren't even born when the Beatles landed in America, yet it's even more popular.
It's even more popular, that's right. In the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, there was sort of actually the one and only period of Beatle amnesia. older people will remember the Beatlemania was a show on Broadway, and there was a joke that went around that ad nauseum, that, you know, did you know Paul was in a band before Wings? And there was a time when that was funny, because people were forgetting the Beatles the way you forgot, you know, the big bands. You just sort of move on from the last pop era to the next one. And now no one remembers Wings. And, of course, after John died, everybody suddenly, you know, was shocked into realization of just how big and how much the Beatles mattered to us. So, and ever since then, it's been just sort of relentless. In fact, my students now love the Beatles and know more about the Beatles than my students then, because they were raised by Beatle fans.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well,
we used to rebel against our parents, and now the parents are like saying, please, listen to the Beatles.
Well, I will tell you, when my daughter was younger, I'd had her trained, what's the greatest band that ever lived? And she would say, the Beatles. And then one day I said, what's the greatest band that ever lived? And she said, Spice Girls.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so she got a mind of her own there.
Yeah, sooner or later that happened. It's amazing they didn't just reject our music outright.
I know it. But the class went from a classroom to a lecture hall where you often have a waiting list. So you're teaching, what, hundreds of kids now?
It's about 400, yes.
Wow. So what is it about their music that still resonates with young people?
I just think everything that resonated then still resonates, with the added benefit of time sifting out the fact that they were really that good. You know, it wasn't some sort of figment of our imagination. We got really lucky, you know. Mm-hmm. They might not have been that good. It might have been just a fad that died, but it turned out they were great, great musicians. I mean, they made great music, wrote great songs that still stand up and sound terrific and fresh and young. And, you know, 19-year-olds, they don't listen to archives. They listen to music that matters to them right now, and the Beatles matter to them right now. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably because, of course, they broke up before they were even 30, and they're eternally young and eternally perfect, and that legacy can never be changed or tarnished or lessened in any way.
So certainly John Lennon and Paul McCartney as a songwriting team were hard to beat. So how do you think they complemented each other? Because they were very different.
I think that's the point. They were so different as people and as writers. And, you know, it's one of the few team efforts in any kind of art history that actually worked. They played to each other's strengths, and they made the sum greater than the parts. And, you know, of course, you add the band. I think that John and Paul were great songwriters, a great pop songwriting team, really well-crafted. That's why their songs stand up so well now. All these years later, they're just such solid songs. We always thought in terms of the melody and the song first, and then what do we use? Sitars, orchestras, backward tape loops, guitar, bass, drums, whatever. And so they were pop songwriters writing for a rock and roll band, and they eventually became a group of composers sitting there in Abbey Road with no thought of having to go out and play whatever they recorded at second base in Shea Stadium. So, and you've got to remember, they were on Ed Sullivan in 1964. Here we are, you know, 50 years later. And they broke up in 1969.
Right.
So we're talking 5.5 years they did all of that.
It's mind-boggling when you think about that, 5.5 years and what a phenomenon they became. But I want to ask about Ringo and George. They certainly had songwriting talent, but do you think they were underappreciated maybe in those early Beatle years?
I'm not so sure. I don't know. you know, everybody loved Ringo. And in fact, Brian Epstein, their manager, used to say America discovered Ringo because when they came, they all looked identical. We couldn't tell which one. I remember arguing about which one was which. I thought John was George. I thought the guy in the middle was John. You know, and the only one we knew for sure was Ringo because he had the nose and the name and he played drums. And so the fans started shouting for Ringo, and the other three were like, Ringo? Where'd that come from? And I think George, you know, he virtually invented the role of lead guitar player. I mean, there he is in the middle of the lineup, you know, playing guitar instead of back there with the band doing a solo when necessary. He was right up front. I mean, everything, and Ringo, of course, is on a riser. He was always visible, you know, to crane your neck like you usually do to see the drummer. Everything about the way they looked, and as that band, of course, dressed and their hair, everything about them just said we're a unit, you know, we're a band of equals. So, you know, I think right from the start, you know, we just viewed them as sort of a whole, and then everybody played that, the favorite game of, you know, who's your favorite Beatle. And I think, you know, to a large degree, they were all treated as equals. But it took a while to sift out that, oh, yeah, okay, John and Paul, they're the guys that write the songs. But I don't think that ever lessened George Ringo, I think.
Well, I'm wondering from their songwriting abilities, though. You know, George certainly, you know, made some, I mean, something. That's one of the, you know, best Beatles songs ever. But it seemed like maybe John and Paul really took the lead there in the songwriting and maybe didn't give George and Ringo some leeway there to create like they were creating.
Well, John and Paul, John used to say we carved up the empire. I mean, you know, there are four people. How many songwriters can you have?
Right.
You know, John and Paul were extraordinarily great, gifted songwriters. I mean, I think they both said we loved pre-rock pop music. We remember and respect the time before rock and roll, and then they were the perfect age, you know, roughly 15 to be hit by rock and roll, by Elvis and everything hitting, and to be set free and liberated and excited by Little Richard. And so, you know, they were first-generation rock fans like Mick Jagger, like Dylan, like that whole era. But yes, you're right. I think it took a great act of courage, really, for George Harrison. Can you imagine walking into John Lennon and saying, I wrote a song.
I have an idea.
Like, Don't Bother Me, or, you know, I Need You, or something. You know, those are fine songs, but wow, what guts it took to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, as you say, yes, by their last album, he's writing something, and Here Comes the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he still gets two songs per album, but they're everybody's favorite songs.
Right, exactly.
So. And then Ringo, you know, was just sort of everybody's favorite Beatle in a way. The Beatles' favorite Beatle. The ones that the other three, you know, he's the one the other three rallied around and loved and wrote Little Help from My Friends for. And, you know, he didn't have that weight around him. George felt like he needed to write a song for whatever reason to be sort of an equal with John and Paul. And Ringo was just happy to be there and didn't feel that kind of pressure.
Right.
And, of course, was a terrifically underrated drummer. Now, that's one thing that's changed. People used to talk about Ringo being kind of vaguely dumb and not that great a drummer. He was terrific. Boy, you show me a drummer that can play She Loves You and A Day in the Life and Come Together all equally well and change and grow with all the things they went through. It's because, again, he played songs. Everything, again, in the Beatles was focused to the song, not to listen to me play incredible drums.
Yeah, exactly.
So, he had no ego whatsoever as a drummer, which is pretty rare.
For sure.
You know?
Yeah. Now, you require the students to have a pretty good knowledge of the music before they take the class. So these kids are coming in knowing the music.
Not necessarily. I don't assume that. I mean, I love it, in fact, when I get a novice. They're hard to find, but I do get them. This is kind of scary. We're getting to the age now where their parents weren't Beatle fans. They were like punk rock fans or, you know, U2 fans. I mean, time's going by. Just like I saw this happen with Elvis. There was a period when, you know, everyone in class, you know, their dad had fed them Elvis or Little Richard or Chuck Berry or Jerry Lee Lewis, and that faded. I don't think the Beatles will fade that way, but...
That's a really interesting point, because I was not really an Elvis fan, but so I don't have a lot of Elvis music yet. My daughter's bedroom was covered with Elvis paraphernalia. How she discovered him, I don't know, but he spoke to her as a teenager, which was it's interesting.
Yeah, rock and roll is eternally young, and he didn't have to live in that moment to appreciate it any more than he had to live in Vienna in 1800 to love Beethoven.
Right.
And we didn't think that at the time. We just thought this was our music. We never, never thought in terms of this being great art that would last. Or, you know, but turned out that it was. But, yeah, I do have a lot of students that come to class knowing every song. They own every outtake. They've read every book. It's a little scary.
Wow, yeah. So,
I was
kind of envisioning, I was looking at your website and, you know, some of the coursework you're going to, and I noticed the quizzes and I thought, what's a pop quiz? And give us a question or two that you put on a pop quiz.
Oh, you know, the pop quizzes are really like glorified ways of taking attendance, to tell you the truth. Are you paying attention? You know, do you know who Klaus Voormann was? And, or who designed the revolver cover, and how does he tie into the Beatles' early history? Questions like
good
that.
Questions. So do you still make trips to Abbey Road?
Yes. Not as nearly as often as I'd like, but we still do a summer course in England when we can get the funding for it, and that's joyous. I mean, there's nothing like walking down Penny Lane on your way to Strawberry Field. You know, you're walking through the greatest single of pop history, so that's a very special thing.
Yeah. Now,
especially for a bunch of Hoosiers that have no idea what Liverpool...
Right.
It's like when you go down to the Delta and you realize, oh, man, this is a real place, and the blues suddenly... takes on a whole other dimension and a human dimension. And walking around Liverpool and hearing everybody sound like George, and everybody have that sort of Beatlesque humor and sarcastic wit, and it's quite special. All the Beatle fans out there that have not gone to Liverpool, if you ever go to London, just make the 3.5-hour trip up to Liverpool, and you'll never regret it. It's great.
And so here we are 50 years later from the date that, the Beatles took America, the world by storm after that. And I still, are you still the only person teaching a Beatles class in the country? Because, I mean, for a few years back when we talked, you were the only one.
I was the only one I knew of, unless there was some comparative literature kind of thing. Certainly not anymore. There are a lot of courses, and, you know, if you go on Amazon, you'll see there's hundreds of books. I think the Beatles are kind of the easiest sell to, like, a music department, for example, because, you know, everyone loves the Beatles now. The rock haters have all retired or died, so they're out of the way now, and it's not that hard to get a dean to approve a course, especially on the Beatles. But I'm sure I have the longest-running course on the planet, but I certainly don't have the only one, not by a long shot. I mean, again, I have a mixed feelings about seeing this become kind of enshrined in the pantheon, but on the other hand, to me, that's validation that, hey, you know, it really was that good. It's great music. It was rebellious and fun before its time, and it turned out to be timeless also.
Glenn Glass teaches a series of courses on the history of rock and roll and popular music, including a class on the music of the Beatles at Indiana University. Glenn, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's great to talk to you.
You too. Marty, we didn't have anything like that when I was in school. Wouldn't it have been fun?
It would have been wonderful.
No wonder 400 kids are signing up every semester for that class.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about Fifth Beatles. Jimmy Nicol was a Beatle for a week.
Yeah, Ringo had tonsillitis, and Ringo got hospitalized. That in itself caused a sensation.
Mm-hmm.
But they needed a drummer, and Jimmy Nicol was available. And so Jimmy Nicol, they were just about to go on a world tour, and Jimmy Nicol joined them, and Jimmy Nicol became a Fifth Beatle. The whole Fifth Beatle phenomenon is very interesting. It truly is. I mean, you got Stu Sutcliffe, who... was a very important early member of that band in Hamburg, and who then decided he wanted to go to pursue a career as an artist. And so he just left. And then tragically, within a year, died of a brain hemorrhage, which you have Jimmy Nicol. You certainly have Pete Best, which is sort of a sad story. The two people who vie, well, there are three that vie for the... most famous, or certainly the ones who perhaps most earned this appellation, are the manager, Brian Brian Epstein, mm-hmm. and the producer. I mean, George Martin, who were absolutely instrumental. But there's another very important one, and actually, he's the man who first coined the term fifth Beatle.
Is that Billy Preston you're talking about?
No, Billy Preston was an African American and also called the Black Fifth Beatle, mm-hmm. And he appeared on many of their recordings or several of their recordings, but no. What also plays a very, very, and it's been neglected, what plays a very important role in the Beatles story are the disc jockeys.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes,
now
right.
Disc jockeys are still important today, but nowhere
not like
near.
They were.
Oh,
yes.
God, no.
Yeah.
And for example, it was a disc jockey in Washington, D.C., responding to a phone-in call from a 14-year-old girl who was instrumental in getting the Beatles over here in the first place. But their most popular disc jockey in New York, and thus the most popular disc jockey in America, was Murray the K. Mm-hmm. And Murray the K, he was about as modest as I am. and Murray the K dubbed himself the Fifth Beatle. But, you know, he had a right to claim that because the way he promoted them, it was incredibly important.
He saw what was coming.
Yes.
Well, it's funny. Billy Preston also toured with George Harrison many years later.
That's right.
And I actually got to see Billy Preston with George Harrison on his Dark Horse tour in 1975.
Woo!
Yeah, very lucky. All right, so their popularity really got to be too much. So, you know, you think that concert at Shea Stadium, and they're playing now. They can't even hear themselves. And, you know, it's getting dangerous. People, you know, the police are having trouble holding back these mobs.
That's right. Yeah.
And so they realize it's not only dangerous for them, it's dangerous for the fans. It's a lot of pressure. They're stuck in these hotels. They can't go anywhere. It's a mob scene everywhere they go. So they decide we're done touring.
Luckiest thing that ever could have happened to them. Because, first of all, it became absolutely fruitless. They were playing and nobody could hear them because the mm-hmm. kids were screaming from the beginning in places, as you say, like Shea Stadium. They were so far removed from the fan, they didn't even feel they were in the same place. And for the first time and only time in their career, they got lax.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Paul said to John at one point, what's the use of rehearsing?
Doesn't matter what we're playing. Yeah,
yeah no, and, they're not going to hear us.
And Ringo saying, it's not intimate anymore.
No,
that's sort of what they wanted.
So what they did is they retreated to the studio. Mm-hmm. And that's where the real magic happened.
They got to experiment and try all kinds of things.
That's exactly right. They got to experiment and they started putting out Revolver and eventually culminating in Let It Be and mm-hmm. and the Sgt. Pepper's band.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible. Now, a great part of that is a great part of the credit for that is due George Martin because he let him go.
Right.
He let him experiment. And he kept saying, I thought they had really pushed the envelope so brilliantly, and then they gave me something even better.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way for them to really come to fruition.
Of course, when you're popular like that, there's always going to be controversy and rumors. And, of course, one of the big ones was that Paul had died.
Paul was dead.
In a single car accident. And then there's all this, you know, stuff to tell us that, see, look, you know, he's barefoot in the Abbey Road cover.
Yeah.
And there's something, I buried Paul in one of the...
And if you play certain of the records backwards, you get clues as to how he died.
Of course, I remember all of that hype back then. And then, of course, there was the time where John on British television told an interviewer that they were more popular than Jesus.
Well, that's right. And that actually culminated in stuff we can't imagine today. And that is crowds of teenagers and young and adults burning Beatles albums and stuff. And he actually had never said we're greater than. He said we're more popular than.
Yeah.
Still, it was.
But
to his credit, or maybe because he understood he had to, he issued a public apology, and it did get put to rest for a while. But I'm amazed by how well these four young men, and they were young men, how these four young men handled themselves.
It's amazing.
Through this
when you think of that, I mean, that popularity is really hard. And you know, there are only four people on the planet, two who are now deceased, that would know what that experience is like.
Exactly
and it's the four
right.
of them.
It's exactly right. And I have a great quote, I think, in the books of one of them. Nobody knows what it was like to be a Beatle except the four of us.
Except the
Beatles.
And
that's a whole different ballgame, you know.
Yeah, and so they start going to the studio, and of course they've been together now for quite a while. I mean, not, they've been in America, but they've been together since they were teenagers.
Since they were kids.
They've known each other long, and now you've got the confines of the studio and their lives going in different directions. You know, John's marriage has dissolved and he's now with Yoko, and I'm not sure when Ringo's marriage dissolved, but there are these tensions. And
George wants to go off. And first of all, George is the spiritual being.
Right, and George got them interested in that.
Exactly, yeah. And he's the one who brought them to the Maharishi, and and we can thank them for yoga being so popular today. It's really true. It's another way they changed the world. But George wants to pursue spiritual things. He also wants to start writing his own songs without the pressure of them. Paul is the only one determined to keep them together. And that whole magic, mystical tour was designed by Paul so that they'd come together. It didn't work.
Yeah, but I love that he's like, I'm going to quit. No, and he gets everybody. And then he's the one who puts out the press release, I'm quitting.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it was inevitable. These guys, the professor at Indiana University is absolutely right. I mean, it's amazing that all this happens in 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's 6 years of being stuck in the same bathrooms where they couldn't get out.
Right.
And I mean the bathrooms, because the kids had infiltrated the living room. 6 years of being stuck in their hotel, 6 years of being stuck in a studio, together, night and day.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to do other things. And John in particular, it's not only Yoko. That's a big part of it. But Yoko did not split up the Beatles.
No.
But that's a big part of it. But John knew what a great songwriter he was.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to write songs like Imagine.
Well, also, too, I mean, I think John, you know, once Yoko and he had Sean, he took 5 years off to be a home dad.
Good for you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So he definitely, their priorities were changing. But that last rooftop concert... It's like one of those, don't you wish it could have been those kind of moments,
my
you
God,
know?
Do
but
I ever.
And thankfully, somebody was smart enough to film that.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
before
right.
The police came and told them to keep quiet.
The neighbors complained, that's right.
Yeah, so tell us about that last concert, how that came about.
Well, they gathered on this rooftop, and they gathered to just jam, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the music was so incredible that passersby started calling friends, and you had this incredible thing. But then you had other people in neighboring buildings who were complaining about the noise.
Mm-hmm.
And so the police came, and the police shut off the electricity. So there were no more acoustic guitars.
Ringo was actually hoping they would drag them
off.
Well,
that's what I'm about to say. Exactly. Ringo was so disappointed, because what Ringo wanted was to be taken away, kicking and screaming in handcuffs, hopefully by about 10 policemen while he was fighting them back.
Because he knew they were filming, so he thought that would make great
But film. Evidently, you know, you said you wish you were there. Yeah, because evidently that was them the last time to be free.
Yes.
The last time to play together, to be free. And evidently... the music was extraordinary.
Yeah, well, you can see that from the film. So life after the Beatles, they we know what happens. They go their separate ways.
Yeah.
They're not the stars. Again,
no.
It's about the group.
And, that's exactly right. And it was Paul becomes an enormous after the Beatles star.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be Sir Paul,
right.
You know,
that's
and with Wings and with the concerts he does now. But there is a magic about them. I have to tell you this, that, you know, I've done almost 90 books, maybe more.
95.
I think so. Boy, am I old. And I've been with a lot of big stars, particularly when Carol and I had our television production company, you know. But I will tell you, there's one moment in my life, I got stuck in a blizzard in New York City once while I was, I don't know. And so I wound up at Le Cirque restaurant, which was the hot restaurant at that time, because I was staying in the hotel above. And all of a sudden, like the place exploded. There were like 20 policemen, and they were ushering somebody in, and right next to my table, Paul McCartney. And I want to tell you, I who love food didn't take one bite.
Mm.
I spent the entire time just looking at him, saying, my God, that's Paul McCartney. I don't know of anybody else in the world who I could have felt that way to.
Hmm.
I'm an enormous sports star. I wouldn't have felt that way if Tom Brady was there.
Yeah.
Much as I love him.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. it's magic.
I mean,
like
it's just magic. And the way I ended the book, I think I ended the book right by talking about the fact that, you know, kids still go nuts the first time they hear 8 days a week.
Which is, I guess, why we've got all these young kids still taking like this program.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Marty, you're going to be at an event March 1st at the Riverway Lobster House for the CAPE organization, Rights of the Disabled, talking about your book, and there'll be some other activities to celebrate this 50th anniversary. And we are going to go out this morning with, in spite of all the danger, way back before they were the Beatles, when they were the Quarrymen. It's one of the first songs recorded by the Quarrymen, which was then John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, pianist John Lowe, and drummer Colin Hanton. And the song was written by McCartney and Harrison, and it's the only song to credit the two alone, believed to be recorded Saturday, July 12th, 1958. Marty, your book is How the Beatles Changed the World. Martin Sandler, thanks so much for being with us. Always fun to see you.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. In spite of all the fighting.